Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells.
We'll be chatting with
David Strickland, a London soccer coordinator. We'll be talking about his team's participation in the upcoming ICHA tournament. So tell me a little bit about the disability soccer program in London.
Okay, so the London Disability Soccer Program is through Special Olympics Ontario. So currently we operate over two seasons, an indoor and an outdoor. It's year-round, so the indoor season runs from about January to May. And then the outdoor runs from about May until about mid-September, if you include the B team going away to the Ontario Cup. And so we encompass about 100 athletes, and in the average season over the last number of years, we've had at least 40 volunteers as a part of it too. And it's a pretty healthy program that operates over about four different levels. We just kind of call them A to D. So the D's are a little more recreational, sometimes not quite as athletic. And then the A-level athletes are, they can pretty much challenge neurotypical competitive athletes. So the only drawback there, or not drawback, but challenge, if you will, is the just the coachability. So, you know, if they were in a high school sport or in a college sport, you know, athletically they can keep up. But if you, you know, ask them to do some of the dynamic drills that other neurotypical kids and athletes take for granted, and coaches do too, you know, our guys have a little bit more of a challenge. So we have a really, really healthy program here in London, and it's very diverse, and we're very proud of it, yeah.
So London's going to be taking part in this year's ICHA Invitational Tournament. Can you tell me a little bit about what led the teams to want to be involved again?
So we've been doing this for a number of years, and I remember the first time that I went along, I think it was a good handful of years ago. We were invited, as we've been in the past, and we come down. It's just a wonderful place.
So
they host a great tournament that it's very social, and it's competitive, and they feed us a wonderful meal. They give us some wonderful awards. They have this wonderful social activity, including a dance at the end, and that's always left a really special place in our lads and lasses' hearts, including the volunteers, because it gives them a chance to kind of come out of their shell in a social environment, not just in an athletic environment. So, yeah, we really have a great time when we come down there.
So are there any challenges in coordinating getting to and from the tournament?
You know, there always is. So, I mean, we depend on volunteers, of course, and we also depend on donations. And one of we'll just call it a hiccup, for lack of a better term, that lies with the ICHA tournament is it's not a sanctioned Special Olympics tournament. I'm not really sure of the politics behind that. I'm not really wanting to get into that. But long story short, we do go through our executives, and we've always gotten approval to go down, but we have to stay within a strict budget. So I know originally, I think before I was on board, about 10 years ago, we would go down and make this kind of a weekend event or have an overnight. So now, currently, since I've been involved, we're limited to just coming down early in the morning, and then we go home at night. So it makes for a very long day, an extremely early morning, and as you know, with intellectually challenged athletes, you know, that can present some issues, and it's taxing on the volunteers. But like I say, it's such a highly rewarding experience we just, you know, we always really fight to make sure that we're there and have a wonderful time.
So, in your experience with the tournament, what's been the greatest success moment that you've witnessed?
We have a motto in Special Olympics: "Let me win, but if I cannot win, let me be brave in the attempt." So, you know, we try and live by that. But for me, it's not about winning. For me, winning is when the athletes do their best and connect with other athletes, and that resonates throughout. So, we've had some incredibly, all the various levels. We've had successes as far as our teams have won in the different divisions and/or have made it to the finals and had really exciting matches against. A lot of times, the hometown wins are. But for me, the big highlight of the tournament is always is the dance. So I still remember the very first time I came up. I didn't realize how much it meant to the athletes to have the dance and the social time along at the tournament. So they're all connecting with each other and making friends with all the different various teams and athletes there. An entire plethora of personalities. By the time the dance came out and they served up this wonderful meal, we had lads and lasses that had changed into like suits and ties, and we had girls that I'm coaching that are ladies, but to me they're always, you know, young girls because I just kind of have that father approach when I coach. And so we saw some of the girls changing into these incredible outfits and dresses and turning heads, and just the interaction of we had that one particular year there was a team from the States and there were teams from all over Ontario, and just the interaction of the club and their volunteers at Windsor that are putting on this great time, but also the athletes that are just connecting and dancing and just exposing a side of themselves that I hadn't really been a part of at that point. So, I mean, it was a really special time, you know, and, you know, I honestly believe the successes are these guys connecting with other athletes like themselves, having an experience that is in a new environment or an out-of-town tournament, and then just, you know, being able to, you know, relish, if you will, this wonderful outing that the Windsor ICHA has put on for them, because it is a really special time for us.
So, in terms of the soccer itself, how does special needs soccer differ from the able-bodied equivalent, or in what ways is it the same?
So, you've got there's some various dynamics at play with that. So I think I've kind of addressed a little bit as far as the functionality. So I've coached a very high level of women's level. I took a team to Italy for a World Masters tournament. So I've had experience at that level, right down to grassroots, recreational soccer and everything in between. And then also with Special Olympics, I've had the privilege of working nationals and Ontario games and this and that. So as much as we try and align it the same, there are some distinct differences. The coachability, I mean, I never underestimate an athlete that we're coaching, but some of the limitations, and I don't like to use the word limitation, but sometimes you're kind of entrapped in a timeline where to educate and coach some of these guys, you don't get as much time perhaps to work with athletes that you would with in a competitive environment. And again, you know, like sometimes you can simply ask an athlete to go left, but because of his talents, he's going to go right as many times as he goes left. With neurotypical higher-level competitive athletes. You know, they're a little bit more ahead of the game as far as that side of it. Also, we play with fewer players on. We still follow a FIFA body of guidelines within reason, but depending on the environment, like a lot of times we're playing indoor tournaments, we'll be playing, now they've moved to 7v7, so 6 players out and then 1 goalie. So it's a little bit more of a miniaturized game compared to the open field of 11-on-11. Although I believe before I came along they were trying that, but just due to the limitations in numbers and facilities and just the dynamics. So, for instance, when you're working with D-level athletes, physically, by the time they get, say, in a full-out run from their own goal line to half of the mini field, when you get to the higher-level athletes, these guys haven't even crossed maybe about halfway through to the 18-yard box, and the high-level athletes have already gone to the other end of the field and back. So there is a distinction in that area. You know, they tend to be a little bit more lenient with some of the rules. I mean, we do, even though it's an intellectually challenged-based sport program, we do have a number of athletes with physical disadvantages as well. So simple things like throw-ins that you and I might take for granted Some of our guys really struggle with that. I think I answered some of your question there, but if you have anything else more specific, I'm happy to answer.
Well, did great with that. And
thank you. I'd
like to thank you for taking time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah, I'm more than happy to.
See, we're saying there's a process that allows different levels of competitiveness to actually excel on a world stage.
So yeah, that's one of the beauties of Special Olympics is that they're trying to promote the athletes as much as they can and also educate people out there. I think intellectual challenged people represent about 4% of the population. So if you start doing the math, it's pretty huge. So within that body, there's a massive amount of you know, people out there like you and I that want to play sports and play it at the highest level, like they're professional, you know, heroes on TV now. You know, maybe there's going to be limitations to get there, but within Special Olympics, there's an avenue so that there's a regional tournament, and if there's success at the regional tournament, then they might make it to the provincials the following year, and then from the provincials, if there's success there, then they might make it to the nationals the next year, and then if they have great success at the nationals, they might make it to the world. And these worlds are held all over the place, nationals as well. The provincials are held, obviously, in your home province, but if you have success, you'll go to a nationals that could be, you know, anywhere in Canada. They've been in BC, they've been on the East Coast, they've been here in Ontario. I know Windsor's had some fantastic soccer teams, and so that's the facet within Special Olympics. And then also what's kind of fascinating for us, and Windsor's had success with this too, the Ontario Cup, so that's more of the able-bodied or the neurotypical competitive world. The Ontario Cup is one of the oldest tournaments in all North America for any sport, and it's a huge honor to participate and or, you know, to have the pinnacle of success there. And I know that both Windsor and London have been fortunate enough to win Ontario Cups because they do have a Special Olympics division that plays alongside the Premier Division, and whether that's males or maybe youth, so, you know, some very exceptional competitive soccer is played there. And so, for instance, with the Ontario Cup, you have pretty much it's an invitation. So you'll have teams from Windsor that come down that are like as strong as they're going to be, teams from, you know, the Kingston area in London or the Toronto area. And the competition's fantastic. But yeah, Special Olympics is fantastic because it's doing its best to try and align itself with the Olympics and the Paralympics. And it's becoming more and more important, if you will, as it should be, in a big, beautiful world that encompasses all of us with our diverse needs.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, sorry.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Windsor Youth Center is the only drop-in community center for homeless and at-risk youth in Windsor, Essex. WIC provides helpful and experienced staff members and offers several important services such as meals, snacks, opportunities to explore creative expression, resume help, and a safe space for youth to come together. The Windsor Youth Center is open Monday to Saturday from 5 to 10 p.m. and is located at 1247 Wyandotte Street East. Get help or lend a hand right here in your community at the Windsor Youth Center.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from David Strickland about the upcoming ICHA soccer tournament. In this segment of our show, we're going to hear about blind curling from Lori Fry. So tell me a little bit about blind curling.
Give me a second here. I've got to think how to start that now. I've been involved with... excuse me, now it's my turn. I've been involved with blind curling for the last 8 years. An association in British Columbia called the West Coast Blind Curling Association, and it's just a regular game of curling that's been adapted to accommodate those with vision loss.
So, can you tell me a little bit about some of the modified equipment or rules to the game?
I still call myself the new kid on the block when it comes to curling because prior to 8 years ago, I had never curled before. And to this day, I'm still learning, and I don't know a lot about, you know, how to call the game like a skip would do. So to the best of my knowledge, the main modifications are made with the assistance of a sighted guide on ice who generally holds a broom closest to the person in the hack ready to deliver the rock. That broom would be held at various distances depending on the individual needs of each curler. And in some cases, lights are used, again, depending on the need of the curler. The lights can either be attached to the broom and or could be set right on the ice and pushed away by the sighted guide with his broom, his or her broom, when the curler releases their rock.
So are there any challenges in putting together the game itself?
I think, Jen, the biggest challenge that I would... The biggest challenge in putting together a curling team or any other type of sports team is the availability of players. For myself, in a local rural area, our numbers have diminished, and we're just holding our team together with three individuals, and each time that we go to competition, we borrow a player from another community club. Sorry, I think I could something else I wanted to say there, and I know you can edit this out. Yeah, I guess the biggest challenge being is having the number of players that you need, and that's a little more possible in a urban center. But at the same time, a lot of the people that I know of that curl have done so for many years. So like many things in society, we're dealing with an aging population and things are changing. So we're always encouraging individuals, young or old, to come out and try the sport. We also encourage sighted individuals to come work with us. The only difference is the rules of play don't allow sighted individuals to go to competition. And or we would welcome anybody else to curl with us with any other type of disability and would do our best to adapt to it. But most of the modifications are pretty straightforward and pretty simple. A lot of people are afraid to set foot on the ice, but again, with proper coaching and training, and depending on whether or not somebody has other challenges, mobility issues, I mean, it certainly can affect things. So there's a lot of factors involved. But the idea is to come out, and whether you play recreationally or competitively, there is a place for you if there's an interest.
So what's been the greatest success that you've seen with the game?
I'm sure that if I gave it some time to think about, I would come up with a few. But the one that stands out for me is a little self-centered in the sense that it refers to our own team in 100 Mile House, British Columbia. As I already mentioned, we just formed a team 8 years ago, and at that time it was our turn to host the playdowns, the provincial playdowns. And so not only did we put a brand new team together with only one experienced person, that being our team skip, who had played he was sighted as well as with vision loss. And we hosted the provincial playdowns that year. And despite advice that it might take us a few years to get a placement, we were able to take home the first place trophy our very first year. So that's a little success that started out. And I guess the other success is being in general is just the ability to have support from local communities and our provincial bodies, and having that ability to get out there and go to curl in other communities. We've been very fortunate in the sense that we've also competed at the Western level, which is the Western Blind Curling Association. We've also been fortunate in our short little eight-year career to have participated at the national level twice in 2014 and 2016 at the Canadian Visually Impaired Curling Championship. So in a sense, although maybe we didn't come home with major trophies, those are successes. Those are successes in the sense that we've had the ability to participate in the sport. We've had the ability to expand on the sport and get exposure outside our own communities. And it's really found it to be a vital part of life to stay healthy.
So do you find that there's a lot of public support and appreciation for the games?
Absolutely, although it's very difficult because there are a lot of very important activities out there that often are competing for limited funding. But overall, the community support has been phenomenal.
So if you could send any message about the importance of disability inclusion in sport, what would you say?
It's absolutely vital for any person to participate in physical activity with or without a disability. And I think it is additionally important for those with disabilities because there are so many other challenges that they're facing in their lives and so many restrictions to regular activities that it so often affects other areas of our physical health leading to mental health. So my message is it's extremely important, especially for vision loss individuals, for those with vision loss, not to become recluse and to get out there and be as active as they can, up to their own levels of ability. It doesn't matter that you have experience or whether you're going to the Olympics or not. It's important about whether it be recreational, competitive or not, that you have that good physical health because that leads to good mental health, which helps us combat challenges of vision loss.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you.
Of course. To end off today's show, we're going to hear a little bit about blind tennis from Mike Lonergan. Tell me a little bit about blind tennis.
Blind tennis, it's been around for a while. Not in BC. I've had a few members ask about it over the last couple of years. It's out there. It's been around the world in some kind of form for a little while. We had a few kids, young adults, who were interested in it. They were kind of pushing me to find the equipment. And then, fortunately, we're able to make contact with someone who was a tennis instructor in the school system for regular tennis, but she had somehow come in contact with blind tennis and was actually teaching it to a number of our adults in her local community. So we were able to make some contact with her and set it up and get a group going in her local community.
So, can you tell me a little bit about the modified equipment used?
Well, the only equipment really that's modified is the ball and the net. The ball is a sponge-type ball. It's like a foam ball with a ping-pong ball in the middle of it. So, a ball's inserted in that ball. Actually, it's a plastic, like a ping-pong ball. It has some beads in it that make a noise. So, because it's sponge, it doesn't bounce as high, doesn't bounce as fast, but it also makes a noise, so it allows the player to hear the ball. The rackets are the same. The only difference is if they're totally blind, they use a shorter handle, just because it's more efficient to have the handle shorter than a regular tennis racket. But with the trend in tennis anyhow, it would be a bigger head, like bigger surface on the racket. It's actually beneficial for the blind players. So really, the main modification is the ball. They do play in a smaller surface, and that seems to be pretty much open to what you have available.
So. So
in our case, we're using a shorter net and a smaller net. It's only 10 meters wide, so it's not a full tennis, not like a regular full tennis court.
So do you find that the athletes perform as with as much skill as the able-bodied players of tennis would?
Well, the ball's not going to go as fast, but the game is the same. It's the same idea. The ball bounces. With the totally blind, the ball is able to bounce three times. They have three bounces, enough to, like in a regular tennis match, you would have one bounce and you can hit it. With the totally blind, they have up to three bounces where they can give them time to go get the ball, to locate the ball, then return it. Other than that, it's the same sport. It's, tennis ball, racket, net, trying to get it. Outwit your opponent, get the ball back, go past him without him getting it.
So, are there any challenges in putting together a game?
The challenges are having some volunteers, because if you've got, like a lot of our blind sports, you need volunteers to help, in this case, retrieve the ball. If you've got a couple of totally blind athletes playing, or even up to four in a doubles match, you have to have someone who's going to go get the ball. If it gets out of the, because it's going to go out of the court anyhow. So, that challenge of the actual running the game is having some volunteers. Honestly, our main challenge is getting a gym space. There's so many gyms used by so many sports these days that it's just getting space to actually have the game take place. That's our biggest challenge.
So, on the converse side of things, in your time running blind tennis, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Well, because we've just started it, our success story is actually being able to get it going. It's unbelievable how much, people are obviously having fun at it, and there's been some real, real enthusiasm for it. And before, it was the occasional player who sort of been introduced to it by this instructor. But now it's, it was getting the equipment. Now once we've got the equipment and she's got the equipment, the specialized ball and the set up net, we're able to set it up and go. But getting space was hard. So I'm just really happy that we've been able to get it going and get it established. And there's a real push now for us to spread it around the province. Now it's our challenge will be to get enough equipment and enough places to play.
So if you could send any message about the need for programs like this, what would you say?
I would say, our philosophy here in BC is let's try everything, every sport out there. You would think a sport with a ball in the air would be difficult for someone who's visually impaired, and it is. But there are adaptations available, and in this case, it seems to work out, and I'm just blown away by how much fun these people are having and how they're really taken to it and trying it. It's because it's manageable for them, but they're doing the same sport as their friends are doing it. It's something they can do with their friends and in some cases their family, right? They could either the children are low vision or blind. This is something the parents could play with them, and it's not a made up sport. It's a sport that is very similar to their sport. So it's they feel like they're part of that community as well.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
I love that, folks. Not a made-up sport. Something similar to what the able-bodied do. Something they can enjoy with their friends and family and still put on a great athletic competition, which is how it should be. Individuals with disabilities aren't doing it just to draw attention to the fact that they have a disability and therefore should be recognized for that. No. They're doing it because they love their sport, their work, their art, music, what have you. An individual with a disability is a part of the community, not someone that we should set aside. It should come from a place of, we go to see disability sport because it's a great game, because it's intense. I'm pleased to see there's a demand for it. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.